Welcome everyone to Solidarity's weekly Zoom meetings that we're having under lockdown. I'm Geordie and just want to acknowledge that I'm Zooming in from Gadigal land, and I'd like to pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. Sovereignty was never ceded, and the ongoing oppression and dispossession of Aboriginal people, you know, we stand 100% in solidarity with that fight. So tonight's meeting is Imperialist Allies, Australia, the US and the Asia Pacific. And it's especially timely given the announcement this morning of the new military alliance, the AUKUS agreement between America and Australia, where Australia is going to get access to US technology to get us a nuclear-powered submarine fleet. Our main speaker tonight is Clinton Fernandez. We're very lucky to be joined by Clinton, and we'll quickly hear from Ian about the new developments that we've heard today. So Clinton is a professor of international and political studies at UNSW in Canberra. He is the author of a recent book, Island Off the Coast of Asia, Instruments of Statecraft in Australian Foreign Policy, as well as several books on Australia and East Timor, and a study of the WikiLeaks cables produced by the US Embassy in Australia. So I'll hand now to Ian, and then we'll hear from Clinton.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Geordie. Yeah, we are. It's very fortuitous that we've got Clinton for the meeting tonight. Entirely accidental. We didn't know that Morrison was going to make the announcement. Didn't consult with us at all. But I think it is particularly significant that there has been this development. The AUKUS an explicit treaty arrangement between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the US. And in that respect, I think we need to recognise that significance. That it's a qualitative worsening, if you like, qualitative shift away from ANZUS, which has been, the military treaty between Australia and the United States that, so far, although it's only been activated once after the Twin Towers, bombing, but it's been on that kind of basis that we've seen the military alliance between Australia and the United States since the Second World War. The AUKUS actually unites the two major imperialist powers that Australia has sought to connect with for almost the entirety of its history. So it is a very significant shift, and it's also a very dangerous shift in terms of the developing Cold War, with China, which I'm sure Clinton is going to say much more about. And the shift with the nuclear industry has to be seen to be the most dramatic one since Australia's last attempt with the UK. After the war, in between 1956 and 63, we saw seven atomic tests in Australia of UK bombs, and quite a concerted attempt by the ruling class at the time to develop a domestic nuclear industry and to be quite attached to the global nuclear umbrella that was being created in the aftermath of the Second World War. So it's not just, I think it's not just the nuclear, the nuclear capability. What will go along with that is we're going to see, although Morrison's been at pains to say that the submarines aren't going to have nuclear weapons, and there's not going to be a civil nuclear industry to go along with that. It's very clear, that the extension of the alliance in terms of the development they're talking about, cybersecurity, artificial intelligence measures, more measures associated with the nuclear security and so forth, is really going to entrench and develop and the alliance that's already been established between Australia and the US. And I think what we've seen over the past period, whether the US bases in Australia largely made Australia an inextricable part of a global communications network, and a global military network that made America's reach across the globe provided for that reach. Australia now, I think, sees itself as being part of the global reach alongside the nuclear submarines of the UK, you know, and the US, which is going to give it a global, you know, part of a global and immediate, you know, military risk. I think in that respect, it's also important, we go on to discuss more of that, to recognise that it's not just a question of Australia. Well, it's not a question at all of Australia being, you know, a lapdog to the US or to the UK. I mean, there's a very obvious, there's a symbiotic relationship, and Australia sees very much the possibility of advancing its own imperial interests in the region, you know, by attaching itself and developing the alliance, you know, with the, you know, with the US. I think lastly, I just wanted to also touch on the domestic consequences, because I think although we've got the statements from you know, Morrison that there's not going to be a domestic nuclear industry, it's almost inevitable if it hasn't begun already. You know, for the proponents of nuclear energy more generally, and particularly seen it's such a big feature of, you know, the climate movement which we've been a part of, will already be taking the opportunity to say, look, it makes sense to have a domestic nuclear industry now. Australia's going to have this connection via the nuclear submarines. It's going to develop, I think, in that direction. It's also going to develop and raise the questions about what's going to happen with the waste dump that the government announced not very long ago of being permanently established in South Australia. So I think we're inevitably going to see, I think, the situation where the question of nuclear industry is not just going to come up over the, you know, imperialism and the military alliance of the United States, but it's also going to have, you know, obvious, you know, domestic implications, and everywhere I think we need to take up, you know, opposition to it. I mean, lastly, I just wanted to say that that there is historically quite a developed anti-nuclear movement in Australia. The unions inside the Labor Party, there was routinely opposition to the visits of the United States nuclear ships to Australian ports. New Zealand has already said it will not allow Australian nuclear ships to visit New Zealand. So that, I think, that opposition is going to be reawakened, you know, by the announcement today, and it's something that we're going to have to build on. We need to build union opposition. We're going to reactivate, you know, the anti-nuclear and the anti-war movement, I think, to build as bigger opposition as we can to Australia's adoption of this nuclear treaty with the United States and the UK. And we need to, I think, take this element into all the movements that we're a part of, you know, to make it very, very clear that we're opposed to the nuclear warship deal, we're opposed to the US bases, we're opposed, you know, to the military alliances between, you know, Australia, the US and and the UK, and we'll build as much international and domestic opposition to that as we possibly can.
Thank you, Ian. We'll now pass to Clinton.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm with the Future Operations Research Group at UNSW Canberra. The group itself doesn't have an institutional view. We just conduct research into the kinds of operations that the Australian Defence Force will face over the 10 to 25 year period. You know, we go and talk to whichever groups invite us, you know, within reason. And I'm not here to persuade, but rather to inform. And so while, of course, you know, you can organize a resistance or whatever else it is you're doing, what I'm trying to do is provide as neutral an assessment, or at least as objective an assessment as I can, not just about the past, but about contemporary issues, in fact, just what's happened in the last 24 hours. Ian Rintoul asked me to speak a little bit about the history, and I think I'd like to go back more than 100 years to say, even before the First World War, 1909, when Defense Minister George Foster Pearce, P-E-A-R-C-E, today the seat of Pearce is held by Christian Porter, the Minister for Industry. George Foster Pearce had a choice to make as Defense Minister. Do we go with the Canadian Ross rifle, which is a much better, beautifully manufactured hunter's and marksman's rifle, or do we go with the Lee Enfield rifle, which the British Army was using? And for Pearce, it wasn't really a question, because the number one issue, the number one feature of Australian weaponry was not performance or even cost. It was interoperability with the British Empire. And so if the British Empire, the British Army, was using the Lee Enfield rifle, then That's where the Australian Imperial Force was going to go in the First World War. Now, two things about this. One has changed. The fact is that the British Empire no longer exists, and you can't call the US system an empire, at least not the kind that it was. But I think I'm going to try and show, it still is an empire and an imperial system in another sense. But the other thing remains exactly the same. Interoperability remains the number one feature of Australia's weapons and other equipment procurement. And we've seen that with the announcement about the submarines as well, just today. When we're talking about an empire, I would say, use the term empire to mean simply the effective political control of another country's sovereignty. It's not just one has influence, but you can actually control other countries' sovereignty. And if you can do that, then that's an imperial system. It's not based on occupation or the direct rule where you actually put your own army there and you appoint your own governor general or viceroy like the British did in India and so on. But really, if you can control other countries by the threat of force, the use of force, trade agreements where you have intellectual property rights that prevent other countries from manufacturing, say, vaccines, even in a pandemic, because of intellectual property rights. If you have investment agreements which give more power to private arbitration tribunals rather than your own court system. If you have unequal legal treaties, if you've got intelligence operations, like what Australia did to East Timor to spy on them in order to grab their oil, that's imperial control. You don't actually have to physically occupy that country. So in that sense, I think it's reasonable to say that the United States sits at the apex of an hierarchically structured imperial system. And there are junior imperial powers that are right below it. The most obvious one is France, which maintains its own imperial system of political control of other countries' sovereignty in French-speaking Africa, for example, and indeed in its own territories in the Pacific. I'm talking about New Caledonia, for example. Then there's Britain, of course, which acts as a lieutenant to the United States. But then I think, If you consider it in that sense, then the whole idea about a rules-based international order makes sense. A rules-based international order is an imperial order. And Australia is not an exploited colony or an exploited state within that order. Rather, we are a sub-imperial power. So we aren't a middle power, as the politically correct term is, committed to a rules-based international order, which is another politically correct term, but rather we are a sub-imperial power that is committed to upholding the US-led imperial system in our region. And we work with other sub-imperial powers, which do the same thing in our region and in their respective regions. The classic sub-imperial power today is Israel, because it is in a very strategic location in the Middle East. Its population is totally pro-US or pro-rules-based order or empire. It's highly qualified, very educated, extremely well-equipped and well-armed. And if there was a change of government in Israel, you would still find that it would be the same foreign policy and the same defense policy. That you can't say that about some of the Arab protectorates or client states. And so we uphold the US-led imperial system in our region. And Israel does it in its region. Singapore does the same thing, I have to say, in our region as well, but in its own way. And so even when we object to one country like Israel forging our passports, we still work with it because there is a much, much more fundamental interest in upholding that system. This is often mistakenly attributed to the wealth and influence of domestic ethno-religious lobbies. And I think that's a mistake. No domestic lobby like that would have any chance of success unless its goals are consistent or have a strategic convergence with the wider interests of the Australian state system within the international state system. Now, the third point I'd like to make is that we aren't an exploited colony, but we are a sub-imperial power with our own imperial system. And what I mean by that is we control or try, we are very successful, at least in our attempts to control the sovereignty of a number of countries in the Southwest Pacific and Timor-Leste. I'm including Timor-Leste in the Southwest Pacific, although it's really in Southeast Asia and very close to the Southwest Pacific, because it exhibits much of the features of the Southwest Pacific island states. It's half an island. It's got a societal structure that resembles many Southwest Pacific states. And so we exert control over their sovereignty by doing things such as creating a coup climate to destabilize their government that was done in the very early years, to use tools of intelligence and espionage in order to manipulate them. And so I think what the prime minister calls our Pacific family, I think is a euphemism. He's being polite, maybe politically correct. Often, I think it's better to call some of these countries like Nauru and so on as our client states, not as our Pacific family. And for those of us wondering how to kind of break free of this system, well, in the first sense, it's important to get an understanding of the people and the movements in those client states in order to work in solidarity with them, including including in the sorry, I've just been distracted by a video that's come up, including in other countries further to the north, like, say, the people of Okinawa. But that's a separate matter. So the three points I make then is that an empire isn't based on occupation, but rather effective control of other countries' sovereignty. We are not a middle power committed to a rules-based order, but a sub-imperial power committed to upholding the US-led imperial system. And we are not an exploited colony, but the junior partner and a sub-imperial power. We have our own colonies or our own client states, our own areas that we exercise dominant influence. So with that in mind, the goals of foreign policy are best expressed in a general sense by perhaps the best explainer of foreign policy to ever become foreign minister. I'm referring to a man called Paul Hasluck, who was foreign Minister of Australia and also Governor General of Australia. And he said, we have a foreign policy so that we can give effect to our domestic policy. And that kind of makes sense, right? Because why do you bother having a foreign policy? The reason you want to have a foreign policy is that you can do your domestic policy. Well, what's the domestic policy? The domestic policy is one in which real power is held in the private economy. The power over decisions such as what's to be produced, how much is to be produced, how the profit's going to be invested. Those are held, the power to decide that is held in the private economy. The state, that's the government, the bureaucracy, the political leadership, the public service, they put in place structures to allow those decisions to keep being made in the private sector. And the way the Australian private sector works is, we are dominated by banks and mining companies. We've got more banks in the top 20 companies on our stock exchange than pretty much any country in the world except for Switzerland. And Switzerland only has banks in its stock exchange, you know, in the top companies. And we have mining companies. Well, you know, the big banks like the Commonwealth Bank and so on are owned. More than two-thirds of the Commonwealth Bank's shares are held by U.S.-based investors. BHP, which is one of the biggest companies in the stock exchange, Rio Tinto, they have two-thirds, sometimes 70% of the shares of BHP are owned by U.S.-based investors. So there is a shared continuum of interests between the elite Australian sectors and the United States elite sectors. The profitability, the ability to the freedom of movement, the ability to enact certain policies here as well as overseas rely on the same system. And that same system is called the rules-based international order, namely the US-led imperial system. And so when people talk about how we are America's 51st state, or that the US jumps and says how high, or what is it? The US says jump and we say how high. Nonsense. There is no evidence that that is the case. And in fact, has not been the case where it really matters to us, has not been the case since the turn of the 19th century, when a domestic, you can call them, I guess, a capitalist class. I don't like those terms because the state is heavily involved in the capital anyway. But nevertheless, today, the Australian government, the leadership, reflects the interests of the dominant sectors of Australian industry. And those sectors are not exploited. They are able and willing to make decisions. Now, where does this idea of supporting the US alliance come in? The real impetus for today's announcement is not today. The real impetus for today's announcement is actually in the first year of the Trump presidency, when Donald Trump began to adopt rhetoric and perhaps even policies that differed very sharply from the policies and rhetoric of previous American presidents. He adopted a transactional relationship to the NATO treaty, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, actually, it's the Washington Treaty, but the NATO alliance. He adopted a transactional attitude to the U.S. presence in South Korea and in Japan. He began saying, well, if you guys don't pay more for the U.S. presence here, maybe I'll just take our troops and go home. And that sent shockwaves through the region, especially through Australia, which relies on the U.S. presence here in order to enforce that rules-based order, that system which gives a higher priority to private investors who define themselves as corporations than to state sovereignty. That's the real rules of the rules-based international order, that elite private sector, private investors, not just based in the US, but generally speaking, they should have a higher level of power than mere objections of people who are concerned about state sovereignty. Now, if the US leaves, the feeling is that that system that he wrote, and you might have a different kind of model altogether. And so that's when the big announcements started coming out of the Australian Foreign Affairs Department and the Australian Defense Department, that, you know, we're going to invest heavily in defense. We're going to build, buy more lethal weaponry. And we're not going to worry too much about Afghanistan. We're going to come out of Afghanistan and we're going to try and invest here. And so I think that's sort of where... Are my 20 minutes up, by the way? I'm just trying not to overstep the mark.
You're good. You have about 6 minutes, 5 minutes.
Okay, great. That's the point at which the Defense Department and the Foreign Affairs Department began to make real serious moves. And the first move was actually made not just by Australia, but by the Japanese Prime Minister or former Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, who had his own concept back in 2007, 2008 of a diamond democracy concept, he called it. Diamonds means there's four sides or four tips to a diamond. And that becomes the Quad, Japan, India, the United States, and Australia. And it was an attempt by the Australian government. This is the defense, the white paper, the strategic update. These are attempts by the Australian government to show the United States that we have the resolve. And if we have the resolve, you should feel confident that you have allies here who will uphold your presence and your primacy in this region. So it must never be seen, simply because there's no evidence for that, it must never be seen as an attempt of being a supplicant, but rather it was showing Australian resolve and Australian will to keep the United States involved and to ensure that the United States also retains the will to assert its own primacy in the region. That's the basis for it. Now, this was on display in the 2020 strategic update that was launched by Prime Minister Morrison during the pandemic, during the big lockdown last year. And what it showed was the desire and the confidence that we're going to buy expensive weapons, standoff weapons, long-range weapons. We're going to get more and more extended range type weapons in order to give the US confidence that it can rely on allies in the region. And once again, interoperability becomes very important. One of the things we've purchased over the last decade and even more are air-to-air refuelers, the KC-30A refueler, which is an aircraft that carries aviation fuel, and you can then refuel your own jets in mid-flight so that they can have an extended range. We bought a particular type of air-to-air refueler because the United States Air Force fighters and the U.S. Navy fighters didn't have interoperability of refueling their, with each other. So we bought the piece of kit that allows each of them to then refuel using us. And that was on display in Iraq, especially during the operations in 2014 onwards against the so-called Islamic State. And what we've done now with purchasing, with announcing that we're going to buy nuclear-powered submarines is the same thing. We are trying our best to be interoperable to the extent that this may never, who knows what details will ever be disclosed. But you can basically be very confident that it will not be only Royal Australian Navy submariners on those boats. When I say boat, I mean submarines. Okay, you don't ever say ship when you're talking about a submarine. The chief of navy will come and kill you. So the submarines are boats, and we bought boats, which are nuclear powered. And it's a fair bet that the United States will have its own submariners on those boats, simply because, you know, it's a specialized skill. And frankly, it just allows them to operate, just fly into Australia and then just get on the boats and then keep going. Thanks, Jordy. The other point I'd like to make that is going to come up is these nuclear powered submarines, they use highly enriched uranium. Civilian nuclear reactors use low enriched uranium. The United States Navy uses enough highly enriched uranium, just as nuclear fuel, to make 100 nuclear bombs. Okay, there is an exception, and this is a big loophole in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We are not a nuclear weapon state, but we, given that we are going to get nuclear powered submarines, we will have all this highly enriched uranium. And then what happens if other non-nuclear weapon states say, okay, well, we also want to get nuclear-powered submarines, and we'll also get highly enriched uranium. And that has the possibility of fraying the boundaries of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So, you know, you can expect Saudi Arabia, maybe Brazil, certainly, South Korea, and even Iran, you know, will say, well, you know, we're not a nuclear weapon state. We don't want nuclear weapons. We just want the highly enriched uranium to power nuclear weapons, nuclear-powered submarines. And so that has the potential to really fragment the existing non-proliferation system. So I think this decade is going to be quite an important and decisive decade, far more military than people had thought after 20 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is foreign policy with weapons and armor. Thank you.